All right, good afternoon, thank you. So, I'd like to start by saying that we in Colorado were a little late to the party of using alternative methods to case control studies during outbreak investigations, but we are finally getting on the bandwagon and tried to do so in a somewhat systematic way. So that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. So as you all know, population-based case control studies are a mainstay of foodborne outbreak investigations. However, they are incredibly resource-intensive, time-consuming, and slow, and thus it's worth considering other strategies during an outbreak investigation. And one such strategy is using Bernoulli trials. These are also called binomial probability calculations, and what the screenshot you're seeing is an Excel spreadsheet. This is Keene's tools. This is something Bill Keene sent us years ago that there may be an updated version, but we still use this version. And you put in your sample size, the background exposure rate, which I'll get back to, and choose how many of your cases had the exposure, and it compares it to that background exposure data and tells you whether that difference is statistically significant. This does, however, require a background exposure rate data or estimates. So we conducted both population-based case control studies and Bernoulli trials in two outbreaks and then compared the resources and outcomes for those two studies. So the first outbreak I'm going to tell you about is an outbreak of Shiga toxin-producing E. coli at our favorite sandwich shop A. And this was an outbreak that was detected through routine laboratory-based surveillance, and 8 of our 8 cases reported eating at sandwich shop A, and all 8 of them also reported that there were cucumbers on their sandwich from sandwich shop A. And we ended up conducting 2 case control studies as well as Bernoulli trials. So I feel like I kind of need to explain why we were so conservative and conducted 2 different case control studies with this outbreak, and the reason was twofold. First of all, these were huge produce eaters, and all of our cases shopped at the same major grocery store chain and got a lot of similar produce, and so we really wanted to be able to kind of confidently say, this is sandwich shop A and not some other produce they ate at a grocery store. And the other thing is we were obviously getting this very strong cucumber signal, but at this point we were not aware of other STEC outbreaks associated with cucumbers. And so we wanted to be a little conservative and make sure we weren't jumping the gun on that. So for our population-based case control study, again, 8 of our 8 cases reported eating at sandwich shop A. Has anyone in the room not had the privilege of conducting either random or sequential digit dialing calls for controls? No one raised their hand because their colleagues would pin them for the next outbreak? Okay. So we had 8 fantastic trained student interviewers who volunteered with us in return for a letter of thanks from me and saying that they have had outbreak investigation experience on their resume. So these 8 interviewers used sequential digit dialing to enroll age and sex match controls, and they made 574 calls to enroll 12 controls. That is a mean of 47.8 calls per control. I bribed them with a lot of chocolate. It was unpleasant for them. However, we were very successful in ruling in our sandwich shop A and ruling out our grocery store exposures. Our odds ratio was undefined. The p-value was 0.007. So that obviously took a lot of time and work. Went back, did the Bernoulli trial, and while it is rare to have kind of brand or facility-specific background exposure data, our friends in Minnesota do capture this information about their routine STEC cases, and so they could say 2% of their cases ate at sandwich shop A in the past week. So we were able to use that background data. And then with the binomial probability, we got a p-value of less than 0.001. So we were able to rule in sandwich shop A, and both the population-based case control study and the Bernoulli trial told us the same thing. So then we were ready to delve in and talk cucumbers. So this time, instead of sequential digit dialing, we were able to get cell phone numbers from the online ordering system that sandwich shop A uses. They were able to give us that in a few different formats. One were actually paper receipts that had the date, time they ate, and exactly what they ordered. If they ordered online, some of the chain locations, because our cases had eaten at 3 or 4 different locations of chain A, gave us printouts with just phone numbers, and we didn't have their ordering stuff. So our students and a couple employees also made calls for these folks, and unlike that mean of, what was it, 47.8 calls per control, it only took 1.6 calls per control when you have existing phone numbers of people who are a little more interested in talking to you because you're telling them you're calling about a restaurant they ate at. So only 175 calls to enroll 112 controls. Odds ratio was once again undefined, and our p-value was 0.002, showing a statistical association with cucumbers. So with the Bernoulli trial, we used background exposure data from the FoodNet Population Survey, the Atlas of Exposures, back in 06-07, and the background rate of cucumbers among Colorado residents, because we're a FoodNet site and had Colorado-specific data for that, was 46.7. So when you compare that to 8 of our 8 cases eating cucumbers, the binomial probability was a p equals 0.002. So again, concordance between those two numbers. So the second outbreak that we tried the strategy with was an outbreak of salmonella associated with ground beef. We had 12 cases of salmonella typhimurium that were again identified through laboratory-based surveillance, and 11 out of 12 of them reported ground beef consumption. So again, we did both a population-based case control study and a Bernoulli trial. So when we called back our student volunteers to do interviews, there were a few duplicate students from the previous outbreak, and we thought they might kill us if we asked them to do sequential digit dialing again, so we tried a different strategy. And this time we tried to find, we created a geographically based phone list. So for example, we used the address of a case, and using whitepages.com, we found phone numbers geographically close. Some people list their cell phones on whitepages.com, which is helpful. However, it still took about 15 hours of time to develop these phone lists for our interviewers to then use. And our 10 interviewers still had to make 560 calls to enroll 16 age-sex-matched controls, so we only got that mean number of calls per control down to about 35. So this was still very labor-intensive. The odds ratio for ground beef was 11, with a p-value of less than 0.04. So again, statistically significant association with ground beef with our salmonella cases. And when we went to do our Bernoulli trial, we had a few different options for exposure data to ground beef. So we played with a couple different ones, and we used Oregon's data that they collect on their salmonella cases they interview with a background exposure rate of 32% and found a very significant binomial probability of P is less than 0.00001. Using the slightly higher background exposure rate of 40% from the FoodNet Pop survey, we got a p-value of 0.003. So all of these were concordant and showed a strong association between the ground beef and our cases. So this slide is just kind of to summarize the kind of similarities and differences between the three study designs. So we talked about population-based case control studies being slow, labor-intense. However, you do get an odds ratio from that. And at least in Colorado, we've really trained kind of our regulatory partners and our industry partners to expect that. And the corporate owner of Sandwich Shop A actually specifically asked my boss, well, what's the odds ratio for that? Wow, nice work. Not his first rodeo. So you do have that information. However, you need a lot of interviewers, and your interviewers suffer from a lot of fatigue and frustration. And it's challenging. It's exhausting for them, and it's exhausting for us. When we have a case control study with this defined group, so for example, our online orders from Sandwich Shop A, it's faster. It's a kind of a medium time frame. The labor required is about, it's kind of middle of the road, because it is fairly efficient to make these calls because people answer and talk to you. You again, you have that odds ratio. You still need interviewers, and more importantly, you need to have that control group contact information, which a lot of the times you can't get. It either doesn't exist, a facility is not willing to share it. By the time you take legal action to get the facility to share it, it's kind of too late. So it's certainly not without challenges. With the binomial probability or the Bernoulli trials, the time frame is fast. I mean, I basically did this in 15 minutes at my desk by myself instead of having a number of interviewers going through this. And thus the labor and staffing is really low. Because of this efficiency, you can enact control measures a lot faster. You know, with our cucumber sandwich shop outbreak, those cucumbers were long gone. But with our ground beef outbreak, we were talking to our regulatory partners, and we were talking to the chain store that was selling this beef, saying, we're concerned, this is the information we have, how should we move forward? However, you really need background exposure data to be able to calculate this, and there's some challenges associated with that. And you still need traceback to confirm a common source, and you still need to follow those steps. So I can't overemphasize the importance of representative background exposure data. You need recent data. So how many of you have eaten chia seeds in the past week? I'm disappointed. That wasn't as many as I expected. Well, how many of you ate chia seeds the same week in 2006? Okay, I had not heard of a chia seed in 2006. So food trends change. There's also a lot of regional variability. Josh presented on a salmonella outbreak yesterday associated with chicken Kiev. I had to Google it. I have never eaten chicken Kiev. They've had multiple chicken Kiev outbreaks in Minnesota. So apparently that's a more popular food in your region of the country than mine. There's seasonal variability. Who eats caramel apples in spring? But last fall it would have been really helpful to know the background rate of caramel apple exposure. And you also need to find background data that is independent of an association with that food. So using ESTEC cases as a comparison during a ground beef outbreak is not a great plan, because we know ESTEC and ground beef consumption are associated. And in fact, with our salmonella and ground beef outbreak, we looked at Minnesota's ESTEC case data, and it wasn't statistically significant because their cases ate a lot of ground beef. So where do you find that representative background exposure data? So this is my teaser to go hear Hillary's talk tomorrow afternoon at 4, I believe. Thank you. So a lot of people use other surveillance data. We have very limited exposure data stored in Colorado, which is why we use the FoodNet POP survey and what our colleagues in Minnesota and Oregon have. So Oregon is working on what they're referring to as Project Mercury, and this is sort of an exposure data sharing project that we're hoping to collaborate on, so that these exposure data are available, and with larger numbers, you might be able to look at this regionally, seasonally, that sort of thing. And then the word on the street is that the FoodNet POP survey is being updated soon. No one's going to confirm or deny that for me? Thank you. Okay, it'll take a couple of years. But, you know, 06, 07 was getting to be a while ago, so in a couple of years we'll have that updated data. And I believe they're looking at expanding the foods that are covered, so that's going to be really great. So do I have time for questions, Josh?
Yeah, so we have about 5 minutes for questions. If you have a question, please come up to the microphone. And I know for a couple of our later speakers, they might run a little bit into that question and answer time. So if you don't get a chance to ask them your question, track them down afterwards.
Hi, I have a quick question.
Yeah.
My name is Diana Cervantes, and I'm from Texas. And I have a question. Have you looked at case chaos studies? Also, it's very similar to a case control study, except you're using your cases as your controls. Have you heard about this? I just read a paper, I think it was last year, in the American Journal of Epidemiology about this.
Like, is it case-case comparisons?
You're using those exact cases as your controls. It's called case chaos. Has anybody heard of it?
No, I'll have to look that up.
I was just wondering if you had any information on that, or anybody else.
Others may.
It basically just randomizes your case data, and you use it kind of in a looking like a Monte Carlo type fashion. And so they've done it theoretically, and they've done it with one study, but I would love to be able to use it, I guess, some more real data.
That's one of my questions. Anybody use it with a case control, case, and then case chaos?
Great, thank you.
Thanks for the presentation. I think with binomial probability, when you have, you know, p-value is 4, 5, 0, it's kind of no-brainer. But most of the time, you may see a situation when p-value is, 0.03 or 2 or 4, then we should be pretty skeptical, because as you said yourself, you don't really have a community background consumption information. So you're taking some average national consumer or Minnesota consumer, which we Missourians are different.
Mm-hmm.
So So I see some limitations to application of this calculation.
No, I definitely think that's true, and I think it kind of highlights that basically your Bernoulli trial is only as strong as your kind of the quality of your background exposure data, and I agree that kind of having more of those and looking at that skeptically is important.
Also, these are meant to generate hypotheses, not necessarily to test them.
I mean, so one, I mean, at least for multi-state food networks, I think increasingly are using the Food Net Population Survey in combination with product testing and traceback information to take action on a product. And so we're doing less, I think, of these big population-based case control studies, mainly because the control group is so biased, it's hard to argue that it's like the Cadillac versus the Food Net Pop Survey. But the one thing that we have talked about a little bit with the Pop Survey is most of the binomial comparisons we're doing kind of assume that the population survey number is like written on a tablet in stone somewhere, that there's no error around it. And So I guess I'd just say that we've kind of been kicking around at CDC, like the binomial has been like really, really useful, I think, to be able to kind of triage exposures. But I think we've been starting to talk a little bit about how do we acknowledge the uncertainty in the food net data as well as the variability around the exposure data. So I don't know if people have thought about that. We're thinking about it. We don't have an answer. But if people have strikes of brilliance about this, please let us know if we're thinking about it. So that was a long-winded comment. I don't usually do that. Sorry.
No worries.
I guess I've gone to that age where I get a ramble.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and one of the things that we've even kicked around a little bit is working backwards. If you kind of know what your observed is, you can get an idea of what the upper population prevalence has to be in order for it to be not statistically significant based on your kind of cutoff you want to pick. So it gives you an idea about how biased your population prevalence would have to be for it to really be not kind of off. And so I think that's sometimes helpful to put it in context, which is a little bit of the, you have 11 out of 12 or 3 out of 4, 18 out of 20. It kind of helps you know how biased your data has to be for you not to find a result that's likely to be statistical.
And we played with that with ground beef a lot.
Yeah, so
you
that,
know,
that's just
what if it were 10 of 12 of our cases, that sort of thing.
Right.
Is that the hook?
That's the hook.
All right.
Good job.
Thanks, Josh.